Engineering Council for Africa, Peer Africa, CSIR. Those are our colleagues. You all welcome, and really thanks very much for coming. Honourable members, I'm very suspicious of you, particularly Honourable Khaldin, sitting far away after a long time no see. I hope it doesn't show that you're not yet keen to be back in Parliament. We've been away for 3 weeks, Honourable Members, so everyone should be keen to come back to Parliament, except me. I'm so lazy. I don't feel anything here. I must be honest. I wish I could go back and do constituency work. The history of us meeting here today at the Portfolio Committee for Energy is that some time ago we did a study tour to Atlantis, where we wanted to look at energy efficiency design integrated in house, Arctic house in particular. And that's where we met Dr. Mthusi Guy from Peer Africa. In fact, that's why he's here. He took us through. So formally today we're presenting a report of our visit there. That's number one. But we then felt normal. Actually, this is an emerging, concept and practice, that of integrating energy efficiency to various things, thermal control and others, in housing. So, whilst addressing and formally processing the report, on our oversight hall, so that it gets into the system of our parliament, we then felt, let's also take the opportunity and look at this very issue at a broader scale, obviously with the intention of enhancing it. And, one did a little bit of Googling, and then we picked up CSIR, South-South-North, with Steve Stone. I think the name is very familiar. Well, of course, with Peer Africa, obviously, they were an obvious choice, and the Googling landed us to get also the Green Building Council. So you're all welcome. Thanks for coming, and thanks to the department as well. The Department of Energy is represented, and I don't, without wasting any time, unfortunately we started late because of the technology. We had to make all these things. We were targeting that each presentation, the presentation together with minutes, would take at least around 30 minutes. So we'll have to play around with that time, something like 70-30 or 60-40 arrangement, presentation and then time for questions. Without wasting any time, honored members, welcome, Honorable Slau. I hope you are quite refreshed. You do look, I shouldn't even hope. Oh, please, don't be like me. Don't be like me. But there you are. A green building, because we're the first, like an early bird, will give you the... green building. Yes, for recording purposes as well.
Here we go. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's a real privilege to be here, and thank you for the invitation, Mr. Chair and Pilot. We really value this opportunity just to share a little bit about our organisation and what we've done to date and some of the ideas that we have going forward and working together with government and other organisations. I'm just going to load up the presentation if you don't mind. If you do have a printed copy of our presentation, I've cut, in the interest of time, just cut out a few of the pages. So you'll have a little bit more information in the printed copies than what I'm presenting here. So if you see those slides, you can just skip on past those. Great, thank you. Just a brief introduction to myself. My name is Manfred Braun. Electrical engineer by sort of background, and then started working in the industry for about 10 or 12 years as an electrical engineer on the consulting side, and now as of last year heading up the technical aspects within the Green Building Council. The presentation, just a quick overview. I would like to introduce the organization itself, and then understand a little bit why the focus is on buildings and what value lies in buildings. A little bit about building rating tools, and then focus on some of the other Green Building Council's core activities. Just also then wanted to highlight a few links with government, and then wanted to talk a little bit more about our energy benchmarking tool that we are developing at the moment. So that just gives you a brief overview. Just then to start off, the Green Building Council is an NGO, not-for-profit organization established in 2007. And our vision is really about transforming and leading the transformation of the property industry in South Africa towards a more environmentally sustainable built environment. And that relates to the buildings themselves, but also the people that are occupying those buildings, so creating healthier, more productive, more efficient environments for the people as well. So it's both related to the assets and to the people. Important to know is that we're a corporate membership based organization. We have currently about 800 corporate members across South Africa. We're a national organization. And really a broad sector of the industry, from property owners to property professionals, tenants, contractors, government, education organizations. And as part of our organization, for governance reasons, we have to have a board of directors. And that board of directors very much represents our members in a sense. We try to have a broad section across that representing our members, and so we kind of have a range of directors representing different sectors, including organizations like Old Mutual, Growthpoint, SAPOA, Woolworths, Grinica, from architects and engineers to universities. Then we also have Department of Environmental Affairs and CIDB and SALGA represented. So it really just gives you a sense of the broad range of people and industries we represent and have members involved. And really what is really powerful is that within this membership we represent probably sort of 70 to 80% of the commercial property industry. We kind of continuously try and engage with them and understand what their needs are and respond to that. Very important to note as well, we're a full member of the World Green Building Council, which is a network of international green building councils. The value in that is that we are connected to a global network of global leaders in this space. So the numbering went wrong there. We were the 13th official member of the World Green Building Council. And the fact that we are connected to this global network has meant that we've been able to gain a lot from these international experts globally and not have to reinvent the wheel. They've shared a lot of their intellectual property with us, and particularly Australia and the US really informed a lot of what we do today. just wanted to touch on why buildings are important. Should be an important focus for us globally and in South Africa as well in particular. Some international research has shown that buildings, the built environment, represents about 40% of end-use consumption, about 12% of freshwater consumption, and about 40% of solid waste generation. That's globally. In South Africa, in terms of energy, it's probably more like about 23%, as according to the CRDB, their UNEP report, but still significant percentage if you look at the different industries in South Africa. Then added to that, there's a lot of international research done in terms of CO2 mitigation potential and projections, and this slide in particular points out from the IPCC different sectors in the industry, and if you look at the building sector projected into 2030, the building sector represents probably the most significant CO2 mitigation potential. If you combine that with this slide here, which looks at abatement potential, on the left-hand side, the area that's circled on that slide has got, in particular, the building sector represented. Just tells you that the building sector represents the lowest hanging fruit out of all the industries that we have. There's huge potential to impact CO2 reductions and energy efficiency within the built environment compared to a lot of the other industries, where it's a lot more costly and difficult to try and achieve those reductions. And this is something that across the world organizations have started realizing, like the European Union and many other organizations are starting to much more proactively target the built environment. With that said, a very important part of our organization is having developed rating tools that can benchmark buildings and compare one building to another. Without those, you can't really compare buildings. So in 2008, we developed our first tool, the tool for offices. But really what rating systems are about globally, just quickly run you through that, and this is common for all rating tools under Green Building Councils internationally, is to identify different categories in a building's environmental performance that can be improved, and then to identify specific initiatives, which are typically called credits, that one can improve performance on. And then each of these you would award points under, and then total those points and get to a score, which would then give you your rating. And with that, you allow buildings to sort of label themselves, and you start through this sort of voluntary system, initiating a competition in the market that encourages people to engage in environmental sustainability through voluntary means. And what often happens in national organizations or governments have picked up on that, and in some cases even legislated some of those sort of tools as a minimum requirement in cases in America and Australia and in the UK and Europe. The tools that we've developed here in South Africa thus far is a tool for office buildings, which could include government administration buildings, retail center tool, and then a multi-unit residential tool, which is in pilot form. And then just to touch on these tools, each of these tools have got a very similar breakdown of categories, and energy is obviously a very important component of this, which has the highest weighting out of all the different categories. But just to highlight that the tool doesn't just focus on energy, it focuses on other aspects like transport, indoor environment quality, water, materials, land use and ecology, emissions, and management, and then has another category that's a little bit more open-ended for general innovation. But really just wanted to highlight that a really key component, especially in South Africa's
energy environment where we mostly rely on coal-fired energy. Energy is the most important and the biggest category in the tool. Then just wanted to highlight on tools that we're currently developing. The tool that we are really excited about developing at the moment is the Public Assembly and Education Building tool, which is also a Green Star SA tool. This is a tool we've received most sponsorship to date from, and the sponsorship came through the government via the CIDB. And we're looking to release this tool in pilot form in October this year, together with sort of time with our conference, which is at the end of October. What we typically do with every tool is establish a technical working group representing various sectors of industry, about 20 people, and part of this includes industry professionals as well as, in this case, some members of the Department of Public Works. The other tool that we are particularly excited about and is a direct response to our members requesting this is an energy and water benchmarking tool. And a key component to that, again, is energy. And it really comes out of the need that existing buildings in South Africa need to understand, and our members have expressed this, need to understand how they are performing compared to other industry players. The lack of data in South Africa is a significant issue, and that's something that our members have brought to our attention, that we don't have a national database of energy consumption for buildings, which out of which you could draw benchmarks out of. So this is a huge issue, and out of that concern, we've had various sort of workshops and then decided to develop a benchmarking tool that would allow buildings to benchmark themselves against, which is a tool I'm going to touch on in a little more detail towards the end of the presentation. We're looking to launch this tool in pilot form in the first half of next year. Then very briefly, just wanted to highlight some of the other core activities that we're engaged in. This photograph that you see there is our annual conference, which is typically held at the Cape Town Convention Center. And we, in the past, have had around 600 to 700 people from various sectors of industry represented. And we really do a lot to get international speakers out, the top international speakers, and really get, from a national and international point of view, a real leadership into that room, and it becomes a really powerful platform for transforming the market. We run an education program that to date has educated over 2,000 industry professionals, and then we also offer an exam that people can then take that a step further, of which about 300 people have taken the exam and passed what's called the Green Star SA Accredited Professional. And then we also run other specialist courses which sort of respond to our members' needs in terms of whether it's a course on energy modeling or whether it's a course on passive design for buildings or whatever it might be. We run those at various times of the year and then also linked with our convention. Just wanted to highlight, if you are interested, I really recommend attending our conference. Our program is probably already 70% populated. If you want to have a look at the speakers on our website, really can highly recommend it, with top international speakers from around the world coming to present. Just wanted to highlight then a couple of key links between government and the Green Building Council that already exist and that we're looking to build on. And today, I think, is also a fantastic opportunity to build on those and grow those links. Yeah. Thanks. That's an interesting observation. As I mentioned before, on our board of directors, we have representation from government agencies or government departments, including CIDB and the Department of Environmental Affairs, as well as SALGA. Some time ago, in about 2008, a green building task team was established, set up and chaired by the CIDB, and that's been quite instrumental in forming some of the early thinking and links to the Department of Public Works and them rolling some of the PPP partnerships out in terms of Green Star becoming a requirement for PPP projects and the like. And also resulted in a gazette that's in front of the minister at the moment for 4-star to become a possible minimum best practice requirement for public buildings. Then I mentioned this already, the government has sponsored the public building tool. Then the Department of Energy is involved with the development of our energy benchmarking tool through a working group that we've established. And then also just wanted to highlight the fact that we've been able, through our Green Star tool, to get early penetration of the SANSTER 4 standard in 2008 already. So the Green Building Council sees a lot of value in creating those linkages with government and trying to support initiatives that are happening across the sector. Then just wanted to chat a little bit more, give a little bit more detail, seeing as this is the Energy Efficiency Committee, about our energy and water benchmarking tool. As I've already mentioned, the greatest challenge is the lack of data in South Africa, and therefore the ability doesn't actually exist at the moment to benchmark your building. So the key objective here is to allow buildings to position themselves against the rest of industry, and to be able to do that, we need to first collect data on buildings and then establish those national averages. And then the idea would be, as you see on that image there, to understand what the industry is doing, and then to be able to position your building, and then over time, annually or every couple of years, you can then make improvements and measure yourself against industry and to measure your own improvement. Other tools around the world that sort of leading tools that I just wanted to highlight that exist and that have quite significantly transformed the industry are in Europe, and the UK in particular is one that I wanted to highlight. It's the energy performance certificates in the UK, and this is something that the European Union in 2008 has mandated for its members, that every member must have energy performance certificates mandatory for public buildings above 1,000 square meters. And the industry has been significantly impacted, and it's really about creating awareness. And this is done through what's called display energy performance certificates. So the performance certificates have to be displayed at an entrance or on a window to the building, and so over time, the public becomes more aware of energy performance, and people start demanding improvements. And when people make sale of a property or lease property, those certificates have to be produced. So it really becomes a powerful tool for market transformation. A similar tool is one in the USA, the Energy Star tool, which has been in operation since about the late 90s, and it's probably the most widely used, and it's really just related to the size of the U.S. market, but thousands of buildings have been rated. It's interestingly a voluntary system, not a mandatory system, but yet thousands of buildings have been certified and gone through that, and there's a lot of information on the internet on that, if you're interested in that. Then the third one is the Australian tool, NABERS, and this has just recently also been mandated for buildings, I think, over 2,000 square meters. And out of these, we've been researching for our project specifically these tools because they've had the biggest impact, and trying to pick up from some of their learnings, and again, not reinvent the wheel in South Africa, but learn from what others are doing around the world.
If you would start rounding up.
Okay, great. Just some of the objectives there I've talked about already, but really reducing energy is the core objective, and creating transformation in the energy sector. We've formulated this working group that is part of the project, which includes government, Department of Energy, CRDB, as well as Eskom, and various property stakeholders. We've very importantly also are including independent peer review from the states, the developers of the Energy Star tool. Let me just jump back to that. And really, this working group forms a very important role of getting buy-in from the industry and support, but also making sure that this tool is relevant for the South African industry and not just something that's possibly internationally relevant, but not South African relevant. Then lastly, I just wanted to conclude by illustrating how the Green Building Council tries to lead transformation in the industry in terms of green building practices. And that's really to try and target the leaders in industry that are kind of already touching on green building best practice and pull that, taking that sector of the market forward, drag the rest of the market ahead, where people that are sitting sort of 75% of the market, typical practice, that sector of the industry slowly gets transformed and pulled forward by the leaders in the industry, and then following that, a regulation starts to kind of follow that as well. So it's really about leading transformation, not necessarily targeting initially the overall market, but targeting the leaders in the industry, and they will then pull the rest of the market ahead. And with that, I have invited some questions, but I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, I'll hand over to you at that point.
Thanks very much, Mr. Brown. Thanks very much. Well, remember, there you are. What an interesting new initiative. The floor is yours, questions and comments.
I just want to make some few comments. I appreciate the presentation that has been given to us. I think there's a lot of work that has been done around this area. But the challenge that I'm facing with the presentation is that it's giving us more of the institutional arrangements without sharing with us. For instance, what's the status quo in terms of the built environment in South Africa? What type of design features do you want to see for an energy efficient building? Secondly, in terms of your collaboration with government and private sector, what are the initiatives that you are coming up with? I assume that a lot of that work is being done in your discussion in your working groups. But you're not sharing with us those type of discussion. All that we are hearing here is just institutional arrangements and architecture. And with all due respect, I would say, I would humbly admit that I haven't benefited much. I'm sorry to say it, but all I'm hearing is the institutional arrangement. You're not saying to me, this is how we want to see energy efficient building to whether it gives us ceilings, whatever, the design features of it. These are the regulations that the government is passing for all new buildings. But we haven't heard that. Maybe I didn't pay much attention to it.
No, thanks. I think Aramula has just covered because I also wanted to get you understand in terms of the issues of the regulations, because I also see here that we have an issue or issues around our benchmark. But I think the benchmark is also being, you know, designed by you, given to the department. But I don't get it clear in terms of what is going to be able to assist us and to achieve. Because we want to know from here where to. Because you can't always have strategies endlessly, because it's like, it is like a strategy, what is, you know, what is there, and but how to implement this thing, it doesn't help.
Unfortunately, sir, I don't seem to be finding pages. I wanted to refer to pages. But you have your green star as a rating system. Slide here. Which as we passed it, I thought it needs to be more simplified and be realized. If you can give it in such a manner that it's easily implementable, even by lay people, because we don't have to be experts to be on the operational side of making energy efficient a success. That is the one area. You made emphasis in another one on the around the green star. SA categories, including the energy. Of the energy being an important area of focus around the tools that need to be looked at, or the categories that need to be looked at. But when you come to the establishment, as you make reference to your board of directors, energy is not involved. And my question was, but if this is the real category, why is it not part of the main body that deals with the challenge? And then on the other slide, you make reference to pilot tools. Pilot tools that need to be realized this year and next year. My question is where? The pilot tools to be realized in October, or the public assembly and education building. I have made a statement in Parliament demanding from Parliament that we need to lead as an example, and therefore all our globes and everything here needs to be of a green nature. And when I see this, I say, oh, at least it looks like we're getting somewhere. Can you perhaps get us hopeful as to whether Parliament would be one of those first buildings that could be looked at in the pilot? Parliament and Union Building, to me, should be priority, because we must lead by example. And the same thing on these areas of the energy and water benchmarking tools, that the pilot should be done next year. Where, which areas are your priorities in this section? On your slide dealing with the education program, educational courses, very interesting. You already trained over 2,000 people, approximately 300 people passed exams and so on, and you're still looking at specialist courses, including conferences and day courses. It is my view that this matter needs to be discussed and make it mandatory to public representatives, and I'm not referring to MPs only, by public representatives, just from local government level, councillors, MPLs, MPs, and all other people that serve public, including justice and others. It must be mandatory that they all should go through that program on energy efficiency, because that is the only way through which these people can play a role as part of government to ensure that the issue of a clean environment is observed, and if it is made mandatory to them. Whether we do it by regulation or whatever, well, the tools can be looked at a later stage. But it's my view that public representatives must be obliged to attend that kind of training and to be able to impart that knowledge to the public if we must represent the public well. The same goes for... Okay. That question earlier of the board of directors linked to it is whether you found good reason to involve the energy department on the at the developmental level on the benchmarking tool as compared to on the board of directors. And in my view, they should be in the board of directors. The examples you gave on international benchmarking tools of the UK and USA, studies have proved that they are the best emitters in the world. In the world.
The biggest emitters.
Yes. Oh, what did I say?
In the world.
Oh, okay. The biggest emitters. That's what I meant to say. Whatever they are the ones that are producing certificates. Does it really make a difference? Because it is one thing to have qualification, a certificate in your building, but it is the other to do something about improving the environment. So I do not believe really that we should always be following whatever America and Europe are doing, even when in actual practice they are the worst. I don't find it pleasing to me that we have them and we want to try and copy what they do because they are worse than we are. Maybe we should look at other areas where things are going a little bit more easier. Yeah, let me stop here for now. I might take a bite in the second round.
Thank you, Honorable Flau. Welcome, always come, especially in the hometown. Just a small omission, with apologies. Because for record purposes, they are necessary. Honorable Lucas and Honorable Matibela won't be able to make it. They've got commitments. And also, both ministers are in the cabinet Lehutla. Thanks for that. Ramka. Okay, Honorable Ross also cannot make it. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Down.
Right, thank you for those questions. I think it's always a challenge in a short presentation to speak of sort of things that have happened in 3 years, and especially when we start talking about buildings that are, in a sense, very complex creations and takes a lot of professionals to put together one single building. It's always difficult to portray a lot of information and understand what's most important for various forums. I'm going to try and provide a bit of feedback on some of those questions. In terms of regulation and impact on the ground, in terms of regulation, what we'd like to see and we see ourselves is very much an organization that tries to initiate acceptance of green building methods on a voluntary basis. We ourselves aren't looking to become regulators or set national standards ourselves, but as per that slide that I showed you, we're looking to target the leading sector in the industry and pull the rest of the industry forward, and in that way slowly over time influence regulation. We don't have sort of the direct authority to obviously
influence regulation, but certainly over time we can do that. And in that sense, just an example of that is what we've done with the SAM Serve 4, which is going to be the new standard for energy efficiency through the SAMS 10400 code that will be promulgated later this year. I mentioned that we've introduced that into our rating tool under the energy category, which forms a baseline for our rating tool. So the idea with that is that SAMS 204 in our rating tool has become the entry level for buildings to be compliant with our tool. So we won't accept a building that's not compliant with SAMS 204 to be certified under Green Star South Africa. So in that way, over the past 3 years, we've allowed professionals in the industry to become familiar with SAMS 204 and actually start applying SAMS 204 on projects, on actual buildings on the ground where it's not even promulgated yet in a country. So it really becomes a powerful vehicle of starting to introduce things that government initiatives, government standards that might want to be introduced and allow early penetration into the market. And hopefully when professionals start now later this year and next year being mandated to follow SAMS 204, they'll already be, many of them will already be familiar with it. So that's just an example of what we're trying to do, and we continue looking to reference national standards in our rating tool and in that way promote standards that are being generated, but also at the same time influence standards that could possibly be improved over time. In terms of actual buildings on the ground that have been certified, there's only 5 buildings thus far that have been certified, and it's unfortunate that we launched the organization just about the time when the economic downturn started happening, so we've definitely felt that. But we already last year we started seeing a significant increase, and we've got about 30 buildings registered at the moment to go through the process to be certified. And we're really talking about, again, just wanted to highlight the leading sector of the industry that will then hopefully pull the market ahead. Just a quick example, again, of this is the paint industry and how the Green Star tool starts influencing not just the professionals and the property owners, but also the manufacturers. The first Green Star SA certified building was Nedbank Phase 2 in Sandton in Johannesburg. And for that project, the project couldn't find any acceptable paint that met the standard in Green Star, which requires low VOC paint. VOC is a chemical emitted from most paints that has an impact on our health. And through this project targeting Green Star, the paint suppliers started looking at alternatives and eventually decided to start manufacturing a local paint that was low VOC. And in that way, there's an example of actual market transformation in that supply chain where paint manufacturers, and there's sort of 2 or 3 paint manufacturers that have now followed. And just an example of how Green Star started to influence and impact things on the ground and in that supply chain. There was also a comment just about whether the tool can be sort of implemented by lay people and understood by sort of the general people. I think the professionals that we're targeting, it's really the industry professionals that we're targeting in terms of implementation on the ground, but the tool needs to be understood as much as possible by anyone in an organization, from the facilities manager to the person who switches on and off the lights to the person who's actually designing the system, the engineer. So we need to make sure that even though it's probably a fairly technical tool, that it can reach anyone in an organization and be understood by a broad spectrum of people. And that's something that we need to continually try and improve on and are working on at the moment as well, to make sure that we are reaching a broader sector to create more awareness and better understanding. I think the point is very well made about our board needing to have representation in terms of energy specifically, and that's something that our CEO has also picked up. New CEO Brian Wilkinson has joined us last week, And one of the first things he's noticed already is where's the representation on the board in terms of energy. And we'd certainly welcome that and be wanting to invite others from the industry and government to represent us on the board in that way. Then there were a few sort of questions around our pilot tools and Parliament, whether Parliament and the union buildings could be the first and leading in that being certified. Just to highlight quickly a bit more background is that the current Green Star tools are for new buildings and for big refurbishments, the way that the tool has been designed, and not so much for existing buildings. And that is a challenge that we face at the moment. We need to develop existing buildings tools, and hence we've started with the energy benchmarking tool itself, which will form ultimately part of the existing buildings tool. So unless Parliament and the buildings, as an example, were to do major refurbishments, it would be difficult to try and be certified through the existing tools. Just wanted to highlight there that it's as a direct response to our members asking those same questions. We want them wanting to certify existing buildings. We're developing the energy benchmarking tool, which will start along that road of addressing existing buildings. But not to say that government and other existing buildings shouldn't be leaders in this space, and I think there's a lot of ways of taking those opportunities. It's a very good point that was made about the members of government being educated and possibly mandating education around green buildings and energy efficiency, and we'd certainly support that and welcome that, and would really be willing to work together in whatever way we can to do more of that and educate more people in the industry. Then the last point was related to those international benchmarking tools and not wanting to simply follow international precedent, and what might be relevant in the US and UK and Australia might not be relevant in South Africa. That's a very good point, and we certainly don't want to do that, and hence we set up these local technical working groups, including local stakeholders from industry as well as government, to ensure that we don't simply copy what's done elsewhere, but really make sure that our tools are relevant, and we try and take utmost care to make sure our tools are relevant to South African conditions, the South African market, and hence the tools take probably about a year to a year and a half to develop. Then what we do is we release them in pilot first. We don't just simply release them into the market. We first release them in pilot and get public comment, and then only release the final version once we've taken into account comments on what we've produced in pilot, so that it allows another round of stakeholder engagement and a little bit broadening the stakeholder engagement a little bit further. I hope I've touched on all the questions. I'm sure there's a lot more we could say, but I know we're probably running out of time, Mr. Chair.
Danny, we have run out of time. More than out of time. Mr. Thorne, apologies, we're supposed to be the first, but because there were early birds, so let's go on into that. If you could come and take a seat and take us through your presentation. Well, Mr. Thorn is settling, I think honourable members, it's quite an interesting thing to see that there is this peer review arrangement, you know, by the private sector, and then that's now I take your point about looking at the government buildings seriously. But I'm sure CDE is around, so let me share a little bit more on that one. Thank you.
Good morning. It's an honour to be here to talk to you. I was lucky enough to be involved in early energy policy work in the early 90s, and on the back of that took a number of parliamentarians to the Netherlands under the auspices of the International Institute for Energy Conservation to go and check out some of the innovations around renewable energy and energy efficiency there. That was the committee at that stage. I think it was led by Duma and Corsi. Are there any members who are still here in this committee who were part of that delegation? Yeah? Do you remember it? Okay. Anyway, today I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of the experiences I've had, but just to reflect upon the presentation we just heard, for any transformation of an energy economy, there are some building blocks, and the one building block is enabling policy. That means policy that actually is encouraged to happen. Dedicated finance, skills leading to capacity, and affirming demonstrations. I believe that that's pretty a common bunch of elements for market transformation. But then, of course, you need the indicators and the monitoring of those indicators in order to show that you're moving in a direction that is being sought through policy. And certainly the Green Buildings Council provides both a series of indicators for buildings, albeit young, but also a way of pulling buildings to become more efficient. And that's a good combination of policy instrument as well as monitoring and indicators. I'd like to tell you a little bit about Kuyasa, which is a project which we undertook at South North Africa a little while back as an early clean development mechanism project under the Kyoto Protocol, and to show how that's being upscaled towards a national sustainable settlements facility. So the content is, I'll give you a little bit of an introduction to who we are, a little introduction to the Kuyasa project, its implementation, the settlements facility, and then some conclusions. It should be a relatively short presentation. South North, who are we? We're a network of southern-based organizations that have been trying to learn from the climate instruments, both in mitigating greenhouse gases, but also adapting to the impacts of climate change. And we've undertaken a number of projects throughout the world, initially in Indonesia, Brazil, South Africa, and Bangladesh. And then later on we involved Tanzania and Mozambique as well in that experience. We continue to do quite high-level work around setting long-term mitigation plans and also looking into research requirements for Africa in order to deal with the issues of climate change. As an international trust, we're based here in Cape Town, but as I said, we have agents around the world in various southern countries, and we're trying to get the southern axis of learning to happen. Our entry point has always been sustainable development with some sort of a focus on energy. We've been looking at not the easy stuff to do, but maybe the more difficult, high-hanging fruits. We look at mitigation and adaptation, and we look to learn the policy lessons, I guess, through doing projects and learning hands-on. We put all of our information into the public domain. We copy left. So, the Kuyasa project, initially registered in 2005 as the first project in Africa, the first clean development mechanism project, and the first gold standard project internationally, set out to retrofit 2,300-odd houses in Khayelitsha with solar water heaters, insulated ceilings, and energy-efficient lighting. Here's a picture which is quite well known on the through the United Nations Framework Convention, which has been used to advertise this project and many others. Here just shows, it's unfortunate the colors don't come out very clearly, but there was a lot of piping involved, as well as just the installation of these solar water heaters, as well as a lot of wiring in these RDP houses, 30 square meters in the Kuyasa area. We also put in a number of drainage points and sinks and showers. Installing the ceilings is not an easy thing. In today's ceilings in houses where there's very little wood in the roof, to suspend ceilings as a retrofit can be quite onerous. Anyway, we managed to do the houses. We've got an extension happening now to another 5,000 odd houses in the same area. So the first steps in the design were to retrofit a number of houses, a sample which established what the baseline was to compare the other houses with into the future. We monitored these houses during the winter and had a number of meetings really to introduce these new technologies. It doesn't sound like space research, but solar water heaters and insulated ceilings and efficient lights, when you haven't had them, can be something that one has to introduce, certainly with some ideas of how to best manage these new technologies that you have access to. I, Mr. Chairman, I really believe that we often talk about technology transfer in the energy sector, but the receiving end of technology is what really builds sustainability, and I'm sure Belushi would agree with me on that. So then we designed this project and implemented it once we'd registered it and raised the funds from the Department then of Environmental Affairs and Tourism for the implementation under the Expanded Works Program. We then looked at a business plan and transferred the funds and the registered project to the implementers. In the process of registering the project, we realized about 1.3 tons per household per year for solar water heaters, the same amount for insulated ceilings, and 0.2 tons per year for the efficient lamps. There were two of them, one outside for security reasons. So, equivalent of 43 euros per year were raised as a significant contribution to offsetting the capital costs of these technologies. There were some key methodological issues. How do we take account of poverty or lack of infrastructure when dealing with the measurement of emissions reductions or energy demand? And came up with this concept of suppressed demand, which is now at the heart of the clean development mechanism discussions under the Kyoto Protocol on how to advance the carbon market into areas where it hasn't gone in the past. And by that I mean a lot into sub-Saharan Africa. So what does it mean? It says, what would be the satisfied level of service that would be not a minimum, but the level that people would reach in order to satisfy their energy service needs, and how does that differ from achieving that through inefficient means or through business as usual means, like in this case, an electric hot water geyser where you store the water, or a house without insulated ceilings, or in this case, light bulbs which were normally incandescent. We argued this was a very important point to bring up, because otherwise people, as they develop, would lock into dirty technologies, and we'd then have to find ways of moving them towards cleaner technologies into the future. So rather than waiting for people to get dirty enough to qualify to get clean, it was a good idea to intervene early on to allow for investments in clean technologies that would also satisfy these service needs a whole lot better. It's been quite difficult because, of course, the regulators of this market want to see real and measurable emissions reductions. But we've succeeded in getting a standard now happening at the United Nations, and we think we're on the way to delivering suppressed demand credits for projects which are dealing with access to new technologies and cleaner infrastructures as well. There's always a difficulty between rigor and simplicity versus simplicity in this carbon measuring game. Some notes. The implementation is completed. There are many small sources of emissions make transaction costs high, and that's typically been why the carbon market hasn't gone into places where there are very low emission sources scattered all over the place. The implementation costs around about 30 million. we have to pay around about $200,000 for verifying the monitoring. And we're now looking at scale, and in that light, you know, what kind of public investments could be available, and who owns the credits, and how they're used to advance the access to cleaner technologies. We also believe, and as I said, we've kind of won the argument now at the United Nations level, that we need to account for the suppressed demand as a result of poverty or lack of infrastructure. It may be into the future, as the Kyoto runs out of steam in 2012, unless it's a Kyoto 2 phase, that this new climate instrument called Nationally Appropriate Mitigation Actions that uses international public funds might be a more appropriate way to go when it comes to low-income housing. But we're still to see any NAMAs actually really happen so far. So once we've done this project, we thought, okay, well, how do we scale this up to make it useful for many more communities in our country? And in doing that, we came up with this idea of a national sustainable settlement facility, which would be a clearinghouse that enables and incentivizes access to finance for clean energy services in all low-income housing in South Africa. And it would be a facility that would administer a program of activities under the Clean Development Mechanism and leverages and manages additional funds from public funding and other interested parties. To date, with City Council, we developed CUIATA, this is Cape Town City Council, as a pilot. We had REAP, Renewable Energy Energy Efficiency Program Partnership Funding, to explore viable models for replication. We've now seen the United Nations Framework Convention approve programs under the Clean Development Mechanism as an avenue for accessing carbon finance. We established a drafting group to provide guidance and legitimacy to the whole program. And the CUIATA project was implemented by South African Export Development Fund with DEET funding, as I said. The NEDA funded development of a business plan for this facility. The Export Development Fund, once again, and the Energy Development Corporation funding for the development of the solar water heater methodologies, which we've tabled with the United Nations Clean Development Mechanism Secretariat and panels. The NEDA funded work to achieve government endorsement and buy-in from the settlements department. And we also then got TBSA funding for the development of thermal performance methods, which would mean we could get carbon credits for improving the performance of the structures themselves. So at the moment, this facility is working on institutional and financial architecture. We're doing some technical work around the methodologies and establishing this and registering this program of activities. And the next step will be to build this interface with housing developers. At the moment, the Development Bank, with the funding support of the German Development Bank, KfW, are supporting the next steps currently. The leadership of this drafting group was established to guide us on how to move, and that included DSA, SANERI, Department of Human Settlements, Department of Energy, ESCOM, National Housing Finance Corporation, the designated national authority in the Department of Energy for CDM projects, and ourselves, as well as the municipalities. We wanted to discover where we thought this facility should be best situated, and it seems like the Development Bank is very keen to host it, although maybe not all of it, but at least part that deals with the distribution of funds through their normal channels. The income from carbon, demand side management, maybe renewable energy certificates and other external interests would be pulled together to cover the incremental cost of these investments in new and existing low-income housing. It's essential internationally that if you want to move energy efficiency on through using demand side management, that utilities need to be able to cover or recover their loss of earnings through improvements in efficiency. That's one of the key indicators for success in demand-side management, and it's something which I hope this committee can take forward. It's a serious issue. It's one of the main reasons that we find our city councils saying that they want to support energy efficiency, yet their major income comes from sale of electricity. And likewise, we find a similar situation with the national utility, Eskom, here. So in terms of the financing, we did some cash flow analysis and realized that this facility could more than break even, but it would need about 7 years or so to get there. And the key was how to find that income that came in the future being delivered into the present as capital funds for the investment in housing. We suggested an approach for this facility, and this was the kind of institutional architecture we came up with various methods under a program of activities, with a loan facility, some equity into this National Sustainable Settlements Facility, and various housing projects coming in and making use of the advance of funds to improve new and existing housing. So in terms of the methodology, two new large-scale methods are underway. I've tabled the solar water heating method probably about 7 or 8 times with the United Nations without success. I'm trying to include the suppressed demand issue, and the standard was only agreed to about a month ago. So now the door seems open for both this and the method for improving thermal performance. So what are high-level benefits of doing this? Well, certainly there would be a respiratory health burden that would be reduced in houses that would otherwise burn kerosene or maybe biomass, provision of hot water, and here health and comfort improvements, cost savings to the households themselves in achieving a similar level of service using fossil fuels, for example. Improvements in number of employment opportunities compared with just supply-side interventions. In terms of economic benefits, there would be a reduction in peak demand for electricity. And this is highly significant. I mean, we're facing now huge investments in the country in electricity infrastructure. I mean, I think the nuclear power stations are coming in around about $7,000 a kilowatt. So where do we spend this? I mean, what is a kilowatt, first of all? If you think of a one-bar heater in a house, that's the demand of a single kilowatt. Where do you want to put that money, the $7,000? In the infrastructure, the steel and concrete of power stations or in people's houses that they can reduce their need for that one-bar heater? My sense is somewhere in between. And it's a serious equity issue that we need to look at in terms of the supply side and demand side interventions. So we also think there would be some entrepreneurial opportunities for sure coming out of this, and that we're already seeing that in terms of what's happening within the solar water heater market, but who knows how that could be expanded to other efficiency benefits. Environmental, as I said, this could be the largest project or program of its kind in Africa, and would show tremendous leadership, certainly from South Africa. You know, the city of Cape Town has set this 10% target by 2010. That's 80,000 houses. I don't think they've reached it. But, I mean, there are very significant policy misalignments, particularly the city getting most of its money from electricity, and then at the same time encouraging alternative fuels doesn't really align very well. And this also means that South Africa can get closer to its 34% reduction against business as usual by 2020, which is currently the target. And then much more in terms of governance, there's a greater chance for local participation and decision-making and the ownership of the outcomes. So some key conclusions around the Sustainable Settlements Facility. Carbon finance requires quite a long-term investment view because you get the carbon credits back as you reduce them against the baseline. So it's only into the future that you can get these funds. But the returns on a program of activities could result in lower transaction costs and tremendous co-benefits in terms of environmental, social, and others. The risks, we believe, are manageable, once the program has been registered. But the issue is around available upfront financing, and perhaps that's the role for these nationally appropriate mitigation actions or other involvement by Treasury. There's strong interest, certainly around this particular program, internationally, the carbon or the climate change community internationally, especially this NGO-supported gold standard program that works out of Geneva. But what is the role of government? The avoided cost of supply, and here one hopes that the energy efficiency and demand-side management resources will click in and provide sufficient incentives. There's the job creation, there's healthcare, and there's the whole aspect of this new market of green jobs around environmental services. Conclusion into the future. We believe this facility may be a model that is replicable not only for low-income housing and state-subsidized housing, but maybe for other types of technologies in other sectors. This could be something that could be not only replicable in South Africa, but beyond South Africa into the region. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Tong. Anne Kuchnick, I think we didn't budget the time appropriately. So can I just suggest a restructuring of our input? Madam Toots, I think you would have joined because we are in the same league. Then thereafter we'll take CDE and CSIR because they are regulators. Much so. How much time do we need to be ready? Okay. Oh, I see. Okay, fine. Mr. Tan, you're still on the hot seat.
Okay.
Oh, there it is. I'd rather combine it. Can you allow to take? No. Oh, okay, sorry. Mr. Tan needs to leave, so let's put him in the hot seat for questions. Okay. Honorable Khadeli.
Thanks, Chair. Commissioner, I just want to check one thing. With the project that the FSN is combined with the City of Cape Town, that is Guyasa. I just want to check in terms of their program, because last time we went and do oversight day, they gave us to say they are busy with the skills transfer, and they want to ensure that at least all the service providers that are providing with these solar panels, they are companies that are established here in South Africa, because at that time they were importing those solar water insurance. So we're going to check in terms of what happened in terms of the outside program. Yes.
Chairperson, I'm a bit worried about the residents of Guyasa. As a parliament of the Republic of South Africa, we are interested in dealing with issues of clean energy throughout the whole country. And I want Guyasa and the SSN in particular, I think we're talking to SSN now, to say to us what is their vision in respect to this matter. I do not really want to enjoy a situation where we say this project is a success in the Cape Town, for the Cape Town municipality. Really, that's not what we are here for. We are here for the entire country. And what is its residence? Is it its residence Cape Town, or is its residence South Africa? One of the observations we also saw as we moved around in over 25, was the issue of the heat control on the solar panel. It looks like as the sun gets hotter, this water goes hotter and hotter and hotter, and after some time somebody must come to gauge to see how hot it is and switch it off, switch it on. Is it really a viable, sustainable method of controlling that heat? Or could you find some kind of a technology that could automatically manage the maximum heat so that you don't have... Because you can't rely on the memory of a person. Sometimes if they forget, an explosion might happen in the house, which might be dangerous. And linked to the first question of residence, can we be able to get the breakdown of the 7 years? Because in terms of your graph, it would take approximately 7 years to break even. And over a period, it can take you up to 2 billion rand profit with time. If you could break down to us how you see this 7 years. Do you see this 7 years as a breakdown in relation to Cape Town or in relation to South Africa? You know, and what would you think you shall have achieved step by step in that process to can say, I am now satisfied that this project is a success? Thanks.
Okay. In terms of the skills transfer, as the member pointed out, initially these were wholly imported systems that were from China.
Excuse me, sorry. If I thought I was distracted, yes, psychologically, I thought everything is over. Sorry on that.
Sorry, the Honorable Dyer had a question as well.
A quick question, but it's a very important one. It's about cost, and you have referred several times to the suppressed demand. We're talking really poverty. How do we bridge the gap? But a more specific question is this. We are experiencing that in those communities where we have installed the solar water heaters, while they may be having some effect, positive effect on the reduction of the use of electricity, they seem to have a negative effect on the increased use of water. And people are now complaining that their water bills are escalating, while the benefit from the efficiency of electricity is not, it doesn't counterbalance that. Have you experienced this, and how do we bridge this?
The skills transfer issue I begin with. Since we initiated this project, we've shifted to locally manufactured tanks. What we're using in the Kriyasa project, we're still using the evacuated tube technology from China. But the tanks are local. Of course, all the wiring is local, and all the materials used in the insulated ceilings are also locally manufactured. The question of success, this isn't just about Cape Town, of course. We had to learn somewhere close by, and we learned. We happened to learn in Cape Town, but the idea of this National Sustainable Settlements Facility is to be able to expand it to the whole country under the Development Bank and maybe even beyond into some of the other SADC countries. So, it just so happened we began with Cape Town. We're now looking at another program, another learning chance in Cosmos City. I think it's Malibongwe Ridge in Cosmos City, where there's a large housing development about to happen. And the point is, it's not specific to Cape Town; it's a national program. Heat control. What I do know from my colleagues who've implemented this is that now is a way of mixing the water, so the pressures between the hot water and the cold water are right in order to achieve a better mixing of cold and warm water. But yes, there always is a potential for the water overheating. I mean, the tank is on the roof, so if it did explode, it would be exploding on the roof.
but I doubt that that's going to happen because there are pressure release valves in those tanks, and they're also, they're not at mains pressure, they're at normal atmospheric pressure. But I'll ask a bit more about the heat control. In terms of the breakdown, Mr. Chairman, the financial breakdown, we have prepared a report for the Development Bank about the costing of this technology and the costing of the whole program, which if I could, I'd like to circulate amongst your members if they were interested in reading more detail about the financial implications of those first 7 years, as the member brought up. I'm very happy to share that. The issue of bridging the gap, I didn't quite get the bridging of the gap issue, but it's a cost issue, is it, between business as usual and the solar water heaters? I mean, it is quite clear that there may be an increase in water usage. I've got a house with four people in it, and I've got a solar water heater, and I'm still under the poverty line in terms of water use, under 4 kiloliters per month. My sense is that water will increase. If you have hot water on demand, you will increase the demand for warm water, because it's basically, other than the cost of water, it's for free. The energy is pretty much for free, unless you're talking about winter when there's a need for a backup, potentially, electrical backup. But it is a bit of a take back that there will be a difference in water consumption between using pots on a stove for single ablutions of 5 to 10 liters compared to having the possibilities of opening a tap and running pretty much warm water whenever you want it. So yeah, there is an issue there, and I think we've got to look at it with respect to perhaps other interventions like low flow shower heads, or the potential for aerating the water somehow, so that there's a sense that we can get similar service or as good as service as possible without pushing up water, because we all know that climate change is not just about energy. It also has a lot, particularly in South Africa, to do with our ability to manage our consumption of water. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for you and your committee's attention, and we'll circulate that document to you. Okay.
Mr. Tan, thanks so much. I appreciate that you committed also, but at least this is a good start of a relationship which will build, as I said from my introductory remarks, this is a new paradigm that we'd like to end. I wish the partnership is there. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Okay. I'm very happy to contribute any time.
Okay.
Good morning. Excuse my voice. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and to the honorable members who have invited us to come back. My name is Mutusi Guy. I'm the founding member of Peer Africa. We've been working on low-cost housing, energy-efficient, sustainable development for government-assisted human settlement projects since 1995. The first project was done in Kimberley. Now, that was COP3. It won the Kyoto No Regrets Case Study Award for the integration of energy saving, community-based, sustainable development methodology. The project was done as a part of our housing initiative. All the projects that we've done to date have been funded through the housing subsidy program. What we've attempted to do and what I hope to review for some of you who didn't, who weren't a part of the first presentation, I'll just do that quickly, is bring the context of a community-based, a human settlement, bottom-up sort of partnership approach. It's not sexy, doesn't have a lot of sexy features. In fact, it's pretty hard. And trying to figure out how to do this within the framework of government and within the struggles within the community and the community structures themselves. And then what we're trying to do is figure out how to bridge this gap between institutions like the CSIR, like South South North, like other very valuable institutions, University of Johannesburg, Cape Town, Stellenbosch, and other research institutions that are doing outstanding work in their laboratories. And we are trying to create a safe landing zone for South Africans who are, and you'll see, developing wind turbines and other local products and small businesses to get a safe landing pad to bring those solutions in and let the community whoop on them. And they do whoop on them. It is not easy. Okay, lastly, we still have a big problem, Mr. Chair. We still haven't addressed the informal settlement community. It's still a major problem. I know Llewellyn and I have been sharing this podium for some time. And I also mentioned in a previous presentation with the Green Building Council that it's difficult for me in the world that I live in to totally embrace those type of guidelines when my number one issue with fire, with energy and informal settlement, is fire. There isn't any rating for fire in the Green Building Council guidelines. So what we are trying to do is come up from the ground up, and I appreciate the opportunity to meet our colleagues, because I never get to see them because they're in their world, we're in our world. Okay, secondly, I want to give apologies to my team, to Quilly and the community group. The members are in the field. They're busy building. They send their apologies. They said thank you for me to come. At the moment, they got about 70 or 80 energy-efficient houses per month under construction. We launched a new wind turbine pilot project as well last week, so they're quite busy. All right, let's go to the presentation. This is our follow-up to when the honorable members of parliament blessed us by coming to Atlantis. There was some little mix-up there with getting it organized, but I think at the end, it all turned out fine. We are co-sponsored in terms of our research by Energy, which is the German South African megacities program, University of Johannesburg, with Professor Hal Anadon, who has personally invested in the monitoring systems and some of the equipment that you'll see in a few minutes. ESCOM demand side management team also provided monitoring, independent monitoring and verification of the savings in the buildings on site. The Department of Human Settlements is the funder for the project. The Vitsan Eco Village project is funded by the Department of Human Settlements through the standard normal housing subsidy. Department of Energy hasn't contributed yet. Department of Health hasn't contributed yet, despite the fact that there's an intervention to try to reduce mold and indoor air pollution. This is a program we are trying to do within the subsidy constraints that are available, honorable parliamentarians, to any project in the country. Where we've gotten extra money that falls outside of the line item subsidy provided by government, I will point that out to you in this presentation. But up until that time, everything that I'm talking to you about is funded through the subsidy. All right. Okay, let's go. All right, from an agenda point of view, let's just review what happened on the 31st very quickly. Then I would like to go through an update of where are we now, some of the new exciting things that are taking place and what the objectives of those things are. The challenges, many of my colleagues already mentioned what the challenges are. I'm going to speak more of the challenges from engagement of the community and empowerment of the community, ownership, getting the community leadership in a position to take ownership of the program and run with that program, the decoupling of Peer Africa, if you will,
on the process such that when the houses are finished, we're not going to be there. So who is maintaining this thing? And then question. On the 31st, the parliamentarians did come to Atlantis and did visit the Vitsani Aiko Village site. By the way, Aiko stands for Integrated Energy, Environment, and Empowerment. It's a methodology. There could be 50 different methodologies. This is the one that we've chosen to use. It's the way to identify what we are trying to achieve. We are not trying to achieve a technological goal. We're trying to achieve an information and methodological goal. The methodology is to integrate energy, environment, and empowerment into any programs that we do as a community. The CO is cost optimization. It means, hey, anybody that's out there in the field, you know you're going to have trade-offs. It is a matter of trade-offs. Anybody who's dealing face-to-face with the community and you think you do not get trade-offs, you have never done this job before. I can tell you that. The question is, people want to maintain the business as usual. My community members want the same houses as Mr. Vermeulen has over there in Panorama. They want to know, why does his house not look like this one? You want to bring this new technology, new building materials. You don't have it. So why must we be the ones taking it? You want the big windows to face the sun. Why must our windows face the sun? They must face the street. So people can see. We have arrived. We have big windows. All right. We would like to... what we asked was for the parliament, and thank you for this re-invitation here, to help promote this idea. Because in our travels, and we were in Copenhagen for the climate change conference, we met Yvonne Vellum, who gave a very nice presentation about her travels to Germany with us. We didn't see the bottom up at all. What we saw was the big, sexy, top-down building spinning and all these commercial, huge, green, mega projects. And the developing world wasn't, the developing scenario wasn't put on the table. Mambella made me laugh when she raised her hand and she said, does anybody here know what a shack is? In Germany, there was a whole room of people who came to the Fraunhofer Building Institute of Physics there in Stuttgart. When they found there was someone there, they could ask questions about a shack. I'm telling you, they asked for 45 minutes. How big is a shack? What is it made out of? How many people stay in there? How often do they build it and rebuild it? How do they decide where to put the windows? Where do the children and the parents sleep? They were asking these questions for 45 minutes because they didn't understand. So what we're saying is we feel that the bottom up is South Africa and Africa's sustainable development story. It's the majority of the people on our continent, and that story has to be told. Number two, at the climate change conference, we also want to be part of that story. And that was the other agenda item on the 31st, and I think it was Corti who came and gave an update as to where the Department of Energy Working Group was there. And we lobbied also in Copenhagen that this model type of project would be considered as an example of what we're talking about when we say bottom-up. Then I am happy to say that the sub-council of the city of Cape Town did agree that region that we're working in would be declared an IECO or Sustainable Development Zone. But we also want it to be declared as a national Sustainable Development Zone for bottom-up development. If you get in your helicopter and you fly, I don't know, 20,000 feet over the settlement, you'll see it looks like this. Very interestingly, in the middle of the project, what you see there are informal shacks. When we started the project, And at the northern tip, you'll see the first phase, 400 houses. The site God gave us faces like an arrow to the north. It's pointing straight north. There were 1,000 shacks when we started. Today there's over 3,000. So the informal dwellings grow faster than the formal dwellings. We started the project in October 2000, Mr. Chair. October 2000. The time it takes from when you take a greenfield project, and this is the difference between the Kuyasa presentation that was given in this project. We were appointed by the city in 2002 to design a project from greenfield on. What came with that greenfield was 1,000 people living in shacks who were already there. So we had to go through the entire process, the EIA, the registration of the town plan, the whole life cycle process, whereby the community was involved in every step of the way. They even changed the street design. They even made open areas where the ladies could cook their meat and so on and so on. There was one church for over 2,000 families. When they got done with it, they wanted 30 church sites. We compromised with 7. But it was this interaction that got the community involved with the project from the beginning. All right. Just a bit of background. The town plan that the city had already done, and most of you know, the IDPs are done before the project is approved. So we inherited a street layout that had nothing to do with the concept that we were going to present. So we had to go back again now and redo the entire town plan to provide as many north-facing urban as possible and to try to design the urban in such a way whereby the shadow of the house in the front would not block the sun of the house in the back. And I think that was a great achievement for our team to be able to have achieved that, keep the green sites as well as the integrated commercial business school and library. So what you see there is the design now that has been modified twice that includes a mixture of houses, includes middle and low-income houses, semi-detached double-story, and so on. In terms of the principles of the program, we are trying to be change agents. And sometimes it's not easy because officials, as soon as there's something different, they take whatever's different and put it aside. Now the community is on your head because they want delivery now. No matter how much they liked you when the thing looked nice and sexy, when there's delays, then they turn against you. And they turn very hard. So the business as usual creates the opportunity for us to be change agents. Cost optimization and trade-offs are the reality. Embedded monitoring, reporting, verification, certification. I think there's only a few people who know what this is. Who knows what this is? It has nothing to do with teeth. Okay, I'll move forward. This is one of the devices that we're training the community on to model the energy consumption in the buildings. It is an energy tap. So we have instituted the monitoring evaluation program. Also, those of you who are there know that there are women, many women involved. There's inspections and so on, government and independent verification. Item 5 is a big one. This is a long-standing fight for me. It has to do with the thermal issues, has to do with the stoves, has to do with space heating. That problem is not solved yet, people. We still need help there. I mentioned these things already, what the project is about. These are the IECO interventions, the objectives, which are integrated, community, small, medium, enterprise-based, integrated demand-side management and renewable energy program. We look at the site layout, water efficiency, energy efficiency, and our renewable program is a wind solar hybrid. Because we have wind in the area, we're going to look at that. The real key is the performance. And I did hear somebody finally say the word service level. Because our whole program is based around what is the level of service. People don't want a solar geyser. They want hot water. They don't want an eco house. They want a warm house that's warm. They don't care whether it's an LED or a CFL. They just want cheap light. So these are the things that we talk about when we talk about service levels. Also, the fire, health, and safety is a big issue for our program, and the self-help learned by doing components. Those of you who don't know where the site is, there you'll see the city of Cape Town. We're just about 40 kilometers north. You'll see that pyramid shape there. This is our basic starting point. What we try to do is look at each of these areas as a tool, as an intervention, not only for energy, but also for water, as a tool against poverty alleviation, and as a tool to create jobs using this sustainable development methodology. Our site looks like a big spider came and sat on top of it. There are so many wires being pulled, I'm going to go into the wiring business myself in this time. And once again, in the middle, you still see the open fire. Even in the energy-efficient houses, this last cold snap, we saw people taking these imbalas and bringing them into the house. Here we see a north-facing roof from the northern tip looking south. When we look at the solar PV systems, we see opportunities here. We have over 50 square meters of north-facing, 20 square meters of north-facing rooftops for the homeowners, which we think at some point can turn into a revenue generator. These are some different model houses that you saw. The city and the province asked us to look at higher density units and different window designs for the community members. We prototyped a couple of different model houses. This one is a middle-income house, which you'll see now. It's retrofitted now with a wind turbine and a PV system and is essentially running off-grid. Other interventions from the demand side, management side, I think was a question came from one of the parliamentarians who was sitting in the back. What exactly is it that you're doing? This is one of the installation methodologies that is used on site. We have another methodology that at the moment I'm in an arbitration case about due to the fact that the installation was done, in our view, improperly. And we refused to pay the contractor, who in turn decided to take me to court. That's a big issue, Mr. Chair. I would like to flag that the whole idea of certifying these energy efficient interventions has a legal ramification and a contracting ramification when you challenge the warranty and when you challenge the certification of those installers. Here is a look at the passive solar design, where you see the shadow line from the northern side doesn't block the windows for the sun going in winter. In the southern side, I mentioned community participation. I'm just going to move quickly through here so we can get to the end. The project did receive a ESCOM ACE award for its energy savings, and that was partially based on a study done by UCT to validate the actual savings. What's happening in the program from a program update point of view? Mellon Housing Initiative has been brought on board as a partner with WEBSO, the Community Housing Group, under a People's Housing Project Partnership. They've introduced some very interesting new housing models, which we've helped to modify to be more efficient. They've also introduced the solar geysers, which you can see here. For some reason, they decided to phase some of them to the west and phase one to the north. And I had an interesting discussion with a gentleman who installed it. He said, doesn't matter if it faces the south. As long as it's up there, it's going to heat the water. Here's what it looks like today. If you parliamentarians were to return to the office, you won't see that open field anymore. It's full of houses, and beautiful houses. They're building, as I say, about 70 to 80 houses per month. The second intervention was a partnership with a local wind turbine manufacturer. They're making wind turbines right there in Milnerton. It's a company called WindWatch who partnered with us to help pilot their wind technology in Vidsun and their PV systems. Now, here's a neat new intervention, Mr. Chair. If you look at the picture, you'll see a weather station. And I know Llewellyn is drooling now because he's got these things at his fingertips. We never get to have these things in the field. But thanks to Prof. Anagon and University of Johannesburg, we were able to install weather stations. We installed the weather stations with the community.
to be able to look at the wind and the solar before acquisition, so that we can now start to develop local data banks and knowledge around what these interventions can provide. It's very exciting stuff for us. This house is running off-grid. There you'll see the PV system. There you'll see the wind turbine. And that little insert there you'll see just below the pole is where the battery is stored. So we can store the battery banks out of view. We put the solar panels on the back of the south side of the roof. It's not visible from the street. You have to walk back and stand at an elevated view to be able to see it. All right. We've also now introduced our third wave of our on-site embedded monitoring. This is a picture of the monitoring system that we installed in Kimberley in 2002 with data loggers and other types of devices like this that validate what the actual performance of the building is and that is the data is being collected and the equipment is being installed by the community. Here's an example of the heat, the indoor temperature graph. You know, it's very exciting when you start to look at the profile of a low-income house. You start to see a fingerprint, a footprint, a benchmark of what other buildings would look like. And from this footprint, we think we can share that with the rest of the country and help create better solutions. These little dips at night, the only way a house can have an increase in temperature at night is if there's a heat source inside of the building. But otherwise, the buildings heat up and cool down with the rise and fall of the sun. And this is, again, another reason why the whole passive solar design is important. Our first printouts from the new monitoring that's being done on the electricity consumption is on a middle-income house. And here you'll see a very interesting chart that shows what a microwave oven looks like. And also shows what the rolling electricity consumption looks like of a refrigerator and TV. Now, this is very important because we're measuring this electricity and combining it with the output of the wind turbine and the PV system to determine what is it going to take to actually take these houses off grid. So this is a very, very substantial and important intervention, thanks to the University of Johannesburg, and I hope we'll be able to make links with the CSIR and others that are here today to expand this. As the monitor, the device. Here you'll see, you know, the counselor showed up on the site to check on what's going on with one of our students from the Netherlands who assisted. There you'll see the double-story house. It has double-pane windows. It's also taking roof water. It has a solar geyser. It has a PV system. It has a wind turbine. It has everything that we are supposed to be doing. It also has a shower. So whatever the gentleman said, what do you do about the take-back? What we did is we're piloting the shower and the bathtub. Now, our ladies are asking the question, why would you take a shower instead of the bathtub? And what are the mothers saying? But we want the bathtub. There's not a proper bathroom without a bathtub. But we're saying if you use the shower, you're going to get enough hot water for everybody in the house to bathe. And she said, but I'm also washing my clothes in that tub. So even if you put the aerator on the tub, she's still going to fill it up because she's washing clothes there. So we haven't found the right solution for that yet. But we know that we can run the double-story house completely off-grid with adequate hot water. And some of you saw from Bisla who was there. She takes a thermometer. She goes and she measures the cold water, and then she goes and she measures the hot water. Don't care what the solar geyser manufacturer says. She is the authority in Vidsan. Don't care what that guy says. She will tell you that the geyser facing north is 4 degrees warmer the water than the one that's facing west. She's saying it because she's measuring it. Number two, we complain. You cannot take the hot water straight from the roof to a tap in the house. You're going to scald someone. It has to be modified. So we are making these recommendations. Yes, I'm very excited about the weather station. This is a weather station that's being installed by one of our students from the Energy team, Martin Beloy from Guiani. And there you'll see the light meter, the wind direction, and the humidity and rainwater station. It downloads the data remotely and then we collect that data. Okay, quickly, Mr. Chair, to close. Challenges. Well, we still have our informal settlement area. And we still want, and have met with Sinari and a couple of others to look at a way now, during the CPUT, Domestic Use of Energy Conference, it was a huge stoves session. And we said we are going to propose a 1 million house informal settlement upgrade program focusing on providing the best stoves available. I don't care if it's not the perfect stove. If you want coal and you're in the bank, then you get the best with coal. If you want wood and you're in case that and biomass, then we provide that. But we have to do something. This thing is really just irritating me beyond no end that we keep debating this thing. We don't offer. Yet we are giving 7,000 rand solar geysers, and I can get to 8 houses or 10 houses for 7,000 rand and give the lady a proper safe stove. All right. Just quickly, the certification of service levels, I'll just jump there. As I mentioned, we are, in our project, we are certifying a Rational Design Engineer Certificate, which works at every other place, will not work in VidSun, because we are going to investigate that rational design. If you say you have an Egremont certificate and you are entitled to place that ceiling there, then we're going to check it according to that certificate, whereas the city doesn't have the competence or the capacity to do so. In which case, we found that one over-purlin insulated ceiling was in violation of the fire code, the SAN 10400 fire code. Why? Because in order to take and cut corners, the contractor decided to run the insulation right over top the firewall from one house to the other. And unfortunately, a fire exposed the fact that the fire jumped right over the top. And rather than fix it, they chose to take to Africa to court, indicating that insulation is a proper material for firewall, even though it's a combustible material. We obviously are taking a different stand. But what did it expose? It exposed the fact that when you have people-driven projects that are funded through the people's housing process, Mr. Chair, there is no warranty. The community doesn't have a warranty. The only place you get the warranty is when the city properly does a tender and the city contracts directly with the service provider. But if and whenever the people's housing process is done, and if the community organizes itself and those groups who want to engage directly with the service provider, the community doesn't have the warranty of the National Home Builders Registration Council, who collects 3% from every house that's constructed. So therefore, the contractor knows he can get away with anything because the community cannot chase him. In this case, we were the implementing agent for the project. We caught them. We refused to release the funds from the city. They chose to sue us. Now, the problem I think here is if we cannot validate and certify these energy-saving interventions, even when they are a health and safety risk, it is a big problem. If you check in the U.S., and I think Roland may touch on this, one of the biggest legal things happening right now are lawsuits because of these claims of buildings saving so much energy and water, where there's collusion with the supplier and the certifier, that the end client doesn't get the benefit, doesn't get the service level that they paid for. It's not clean, and it's destroying the industry. So here is South Africa's first example. Watch this page. All right, bankability. We're still looking at this bankability thing. We know how much it costs to put the wind turbine there. We know how much it costs to put the PV system there. Now, how good is the wind? If you ask the wind turbine service provider, he's going to give you anywhere between 6 to 7 meters per second. This thing is producing. But what does it produce? Because the service level is perceived by us inside the building. It's perceived by our consumption profile. So I don't know what the right wind turbine is for you until I have an understanding of what your profile is and what the climate is giving us. The reason why we need the wind weather station is to profile the wind and the sun.
That gives us half the equation. Then we need to understand the benefit, the profile of the consumer. I would imagine that most of the low-cost houses look pretty much the same. When you get into the middle-income families, it starts to change a little bit, depending on how many geezers you have and so on. Most of the McDonald's all probably look exactly alike. Most of the hotels of certain brands probably look exactly alike. So that type of information is required. So we're trying to develop this for our informal, low-income community. That's what this project is trying to contribute. So what is the bankability based on? In this space, we have three basic alternative energy grants, Mr. Chair, that has not been used. For whatever reason, it's stuck. This is the money that you parliamentarians agreed to provide to bring alternative energy, free basic alternative energy to the masses of the poor. Yet we cannot figure out how to get it out of the municipality into the project. And this is an ideal opportunity, particularly with the STOES program, to see that. If we don't get it, there's no bankable model. I can tell you that right now. If there is no access to this fund, the model is not bankable, it is not sustainable. If you didn't give the geezer away, I got news for you. The solar geezer, they would never buy it. We installed Kuklinong in 2005. When I go back there today, of 2,400 families, less than 3% have a geezer. People are taking that money to extend their house. They are taking the geezer that's given to them. All right. The link with research and stakeholders, other stakeholders, yes, it's obvious. Just to give you the big picture of where we're going. This is our region. If you look up to the top, you'll see Mama's Berry there. If you look down at the bottom, you're going to see Panorama over here in this left-hand corner. And you're going to see the Panorama weather station there. You're going to see weather stations in Vidsan and Atlantis, just there above the, right off the west coast. Now, we need a lot more of them. In 2006, our team went to 30,000 households in that space during the Cape Crisis program. We have a database of over 30,000 customers, which we changed out 300,000 light bulbs. We put in 10,000 shower heads. We wrapped 7,000 geezers, including the geezer of Mr. Tutu. Now, we have this data. We know the clients, and we have wind here. We have sun, and we have wind. We think this is an opportunity for a large-scale program that would include, first, the low-income families. It's starting in our low-income community who are learning the methods of data collection and reading these things, and we want to roll it out to the higher end, which is going to help the manufacturing. It's going to help drive the market. Because we need the high-end people in Sunset Beach, Dolphin Beach, who are going to spend $500,000, $700,000 to put their solar PV system, hybrid systems on their houses. Now, why do I know that? I know it because when we went to the house in 2006, they changed the light bulbs. They said, look, come here. You see these fixtures? You'll never put that ugly CFL in that fixture. We're just going to buy a generator. We want the electricity. We don't care about the savings. So if they're willing to shell out money like that, and if you look in the U.S., sorry to use the U.S., I left there 15 years ago. There's 40 years of my life there and 16 years here. The rich people, the high-end people, they are buying these things. They're paying 40, 50,000 rand to put their house full of these panels in this place to have wind. That's going to drive the market. You've got to have the high-end people who's going to pay the premium to drive the market. Getting to the close. I still have this problem that's at my heart. It's the kitchen. We still don't have the answer for it. The house doesn't cook. We don't have the answer for it. I'm ashamed when I go into Eco House and I'm choking from people still using illegal paraffin stoves. It's happening in my project right now. People got new houses. I'm choking when I go in there in winter. We tried. We have a proposal to Sunary to help us. We opened the table for
for anyone else who wants to join in. Here's a long list of implementers who are working with us in the field. Many of them will work at half their normal rates, competitively, because, again, our goal is to try to do this within subsidy. And then finally, the team, and again, apologies from Patrick Willey, Yvonne Bellum, who are the chairperson for the VidSun project there. Yeah, and that's it.
Thanks very much. I know, but because of the unique nature of the project, because it's not just about thermal efficiency, it integrates quite a number of things which I trust when I look at the honorable members. They are quite interested, even if in some of them it's a repeat, but there are certain new areas and also for the benefit of the other partners. I did allow that storage to those who are still going to make presentations. Honorable members, I want to make time. Questions and comments, please. Very, very interesting. Since they are quiet, I just want to comment about the fact that now you introduced something new, the weather station.
Yeah.
I know when we were there, you did allude to the fact that we're looking at wind energy initiatives, a very striking feature. Also, on the other hand, we should have responded by now. Apologies, there were just administrative hiccups to adopt the report for our visit. You know how Parliament, an institution like Parliament, works. You can only action things once they are in the reports are in the system. But obviously, we are adopting the report today, so we can move speed and even respond to other requests that were raised at the meeting there.
Okay.
Honourable members, I don't have to make it my any input. If not, maybe rounding up on that.
No, I just wanted to make a comment that the presentation for me was so insightful that I'm somewhat choking. I know you'll understand what I mean.
Oh.
Thank you.
Is this why we do not have questions? Is because this is not the first presentation, and we have been to the site. We were with him there. We saw some of the things he's talking about. So it's not like we are receiving this information for the first time. We want to know about this, we want to know about that. We know that this is work in progress. And maybe we will make another visit to the site one of these days. He says that jungle that we saw there is no more.
But when we interact with other portfolio committees, once again, I want us to remember one thing. There's a lot that is included. The fact that we're using the people's housing process in terms of the housing approach, I think that should be noted and recorded, because when we interact with the portfolio committee for housing, for human settlement, we need to raise that very, very strongly. And it might actually have a strong implication on the overall housing funding model in terms of this, you know, because this is highly integrative. You know, it's not just we're looking at it from an angle of housing, but it feeds angle of energy, but it feeds into the overall housing. So let's just keep that in mind when we did it. You're closing the mouth there, Dr. Mutrusi, so that you go over to the
thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the very kind remarks and looks, because I know this committee is really, your heart is really on the ground. And you're looking for something that is helping the people at the bottom. I know that. I wanted to mention the ESCOM thing, Mr. Chair, because one of the items that was on the table was the long length of time that was taken to electrify. And I didn't mention that part of the idea of this benchmarking study for the wind and the weather stations is to possibly look at a mini-grid configuration that would allow us to bring, I told you I'm going to pull my own wires there. It's going to bring our own electricity to those informal people while they're waiting. Because there's some struggle between the city, like others have said, the city and ESCOM, in terms of when do you electrify. And if a family is intending to get a house within 2 years, there's no provision for them to get electricity. And then ESCOM has a model of 80% complete the housing project before they bring in the electricity. So what we see is an opportunity to demonstrate, assuming that we have the wind, and the weather station is going to tell us that, and assuming that this equipment is as efficient as the manufacturers claim it is, and assuming that we have proper profiles, that we would be able to offer light and TV for families on a grid using a vertical wind turbine, which is a technology that this local supplier and manufacturer has under their branding. So step one is for us to do a small prototype and learn. And we have learned, and they have learned. The people, I'll give you an example. The wind is blowing and the wind turbine wasn't spinning. So the community members all said, hey, this thing doesn't work. Only to find out that once the battery is full, it slows itself down. Otherwise, it'll overcharge the battery. But they didn't know that until we had the workshop with the supplier to explain it. Because those people who want to find a fault say, hey, they put that thing that don't even spin in the wind. Look at it. Yeah, then I'm nervous. I go to the guy and I say, why doesn't it spin? It's spinning. I got the pictures. It's not spinning. Matuzzi, we told you this thing has got an intelligent controller. It reads the battery and it determines when the battery is full. It slows itself down. But I said, I don't want it to slow. I want it to make as much electricity as possible. So put that electricity somewhere else. Now we're looking at some creative things. So, Mr. Chair, I'm saying that our big success on this informal settlement thing is not going to be the stove. I still don't have that yet, unless we get the funding through scenario, whoever it is. Just go door to door. But we want to demonstrate by the time you come again, a mini-grid system based on the knowledge we've gained is going to electrify TV, cell phone, maybe a microwave. That's why we're excited to look at that microwave and see what size system we need given the wind and so on. So that was the second aspect of it. And ESCOM has conceded to bring in electricity sooner than their normal program. But I'll have to give you that as a proper report back.
Thanks very much. Yeah. Members, I think after we came from Atlantis, we did raise this 80% occupancy electrification model by ESCOM. They did respond, but I think we should still take it up very, very strongly, because it's not just an Atlantis issue. It's on the overall, you know. We probably definitely have to know a little bit more about it. And allow me to work with also the Portfolio Committee for Human Settlements and check on that, you know. There may be reasons on the other hand, but also on the other hand, I mean, when you see a high level of community participation in an area like Atlantis, you know, you are at odds to understand why, you know, there's the rigid, you know, adherence to 80% electricity. 10 minutes break, and so it would be helpful. There's tea outside. Just grab our tea in 10 minutes and we're back. Thank you.